The Maggie Paschal Show is sponsored by Turning the Tide Production. This is Talk Radio 680, WCBM. It's time now for the Maggie Paschal Show. Here's your host, Maggie Paschal.
Hello there, everyone, and welcome back. We are talking to the authors of So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids, Diane E. Levin and Jean Kilborn. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And anybody who's a parent that's trying to do a good job can relate to this. It is so hard to just let them have a childhood, let them have pace it out, let them learn things as they grow up. It's quite a battle, and you all are giving us some very practical ways and insights into how to handle it. And I've seen you on various programs, and I'm glad I was able to actually book you on the show.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having us on, and we're happy to talk to you about it.
All right. And whenever there's two guests, we need to always make sure. It's hard for me and for the audience sometimes to distinguish the two, but I know that you all are very good at it. I've seen you do it on television, so we just have to make sure that you both get your comments in when you need to, all right?
Sure. Sometimes it helps if you address a question to one or the other of us, but, you know, that doesn't have to be. But
okay, no, well, I'll try. No, is that Jean?
This is Jean, yeah.
Okay,
do you want us to identify ourselves every time we speak, or do you think people eventually get used to our voices?
Well,
I think our voices are pretty different.
They are.
They are.
I've got it now. I've got it now.
Okay, good.
I needed to hear from Jean to get it. Well, and, you know, you have a quote from Mary, and I think it's Pfeiffer, and she wrote Reviving Ophelia, which was required reading at my oldest daughter's school, and was a very powerful book for people to begin to understand some of what you talk about.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, that was quite some time ago, and, of course, it was a very big hit, so very important work.
Yes. All right. Why don't we talk about, I always like to ask what motivates you, what your concerns were to have you write this book.
Well, here's Diane. I'll start first,
okay.
And I'm sure Jim will add to it, but we decided to work together on this book because I've done work for years on younger children and watched how media culture and marketing has affected their development, has affected parenting, and has made it harder for parents and for children to kind of negotiate the minefields. And I mean, Jean can talk, but she worked more with older kids and adolescents.
I think what we both discovered was that we were having parents come up to us, you know, after our talks and our lectures and say, with horrible stories and sort of saying, what can we do and why is this happening? And feeling quite overwhelmed and powerless. I think that things have changed so drastically in the past few years and the parenting has become actually more difficult than ever before. So Diane and I agreed that it would be a good idea to pool our resources and our knowledge and our years of experience and try to tackle this topic together.
Okay.
One of the things that was going on is that there was a lot of concern about teens and preteens in terms of their sexual behavior, their premature adolescent rebellions, et cetera. And we felt very much that kids were starting at a very young age being programmed to end up acting in those ways when they were older, but no one was really talking about it.
All right. So you, Diane, you were more focused on early education, and Jean, you were hearing this more from the older children that were
more
just...
I focus in my work more on
teens
and tweens. But...
Okay, and tweens, all right, which is a very difficult time.
Yeah.
There's so many things coming at us in the popular culture. You talk about female pop stars wearing provocative clothing and dancing suggestively while singing songs with sexual and sometimes violent lyrics. And these are a lot of times Disney, so forth. Some of them go down paths that are really quite destructive. And that's very clear for the children, I think, and for the tweens and the teens to say, oh, look at somebody like, you know, that we can think of a few of them. And then there's others that are still staying above that, but are still, it's still quite sexy, isn't it?
there's sexual, very graphic sexual messages coming at kids from every possible source. I mean, from the media and the music and TV shows and films and video games, wherever they turn. And it's starting earlier and earlier all the time. So that although teenagers have always been often long been targeted by using sexual images, now marketers are targeting very, very little kids.
And I've started hearing stories from parents as young, with children as young as three, in terms of ways the sexualized imagery and culture is entering their families and the trouble that it's causing them.
What are they hearing? What are you hearing about three?
One of the most recent stories was someone who told me her daughter at age three, they had a family birthday party with extended family, and several people gave the daughter sparkly clothes as her birthday present, and now that's all the three-year-old wants to wear. She has tantrums when the mother tries to put other clothes on, because when the mother put the clothes on at the party so people could see her in the clothes, everyone was talking about how cute she was and how adorable and how nice the sparkles were, and now the mother has a major issue with her three-year-old. Now she's dealing with it.
I heard a story not long ago about a sort of little dance thing that a group of kindergartners did, or first graders maybe, and it was really very suggestive and provocative. And the amazing thing about the story is that a lot of the parents didn't seem to notice. I mean, in some ways, we've become so desensitized to this, so used to it, that it no longer shocks us in the way that it does.
I've seen the same thing with dance classes. Same thing.
But also, when children are little, it can seem cute, and people don't think about how this is the beginning of a journey kids are on, and not thinking about what does it mean to them and where does it evolve to.
Right, yeah. If a five-year-old is doing a bump and grind, I guess, some people might think that was cute, but yeah,
right.
Definitely.
Right. What's it saying? What's the bigger message, and how are they going to be processing that when
exactly.
they get to...
And how does it affect... I mean, the research is really clear that this affects them, that it has harmful consequences, particularly for girls. I mean, there's more research on how it affects girls, but the American Psychological Association did a report not long ago that showed that it really leads to low self-esteem and many other consequences, self-mutilation, eating disorders, so that this kind of objectification is really harmful to the children themselves.
I think that's so key. And I've heard it before. We all know it. It's so true with the eating disorders and the issues. And this is when they're still developing. They need to get that self-image firm inside them before all this comes at them.
You're absolutely right, Maggie.
Yeah.
And one of the things, following up with what you and Jean just said, as we worked on the book and came to understand the issue better, one of the things that started worrying us the most is that children are learned to view themselves as objects. What they buy, what they wear, how they look determines their value, determines how they judge themselves, how they judge others, how they're judged by others, and it's how boys judge girls. And so children, when they're young, one of the things they need to learn to do is to think about how do you have caring, connected, give-and-take relationships, not be judging everybody just by how they look. And we hear stories in school already with, more bullying going on and more teasing and more kids knowing who the popular kids are by the clothes they're wearing. And that gradually becomes more sexualized as we go along.
And just to sort of emphasize that important point that Diane just made, that it is, they're turned into objects in terms of the way other people look at them. But as Diane said, perhaps the most harmful thing is that they learn to see themselves as objects It's hard to undo, if you really learn to see yourself as a thing, as an object. As Diane said, just based your value entirely based on how you look and how sexy you are. That can be very hard to untangle as you grow older.
Well, and if they can just get to adulthood, 18, or a place of understanding and developing that self-image, then if this other stuff comes at them, they can process it better. But when you put yourself in the headspace of a child and how it's all, we're trying to figure it out and so forth, it's just like you said, a time where it's like a minefield.
Exactly.
It really is. But I like when you talk about, of course, limiting exposure in media and pop culture, but also what you can encourage on the other end, which is alternatives to the consumer culture, like sports, music, drama, religious or even political groups, something where it's outside of that realm that they can build themselves up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's crucial starting at young ages is helping children develop deep interests that they feel good about that are not part of that objectified world, that help them develop skills and master and learn what it means to really learn by doing rather than just learn by seeing images about how it's supposed to be and kind of taking them in a program kind of way, which is what happens with so much of the media culture. And the other thing, talking about things to do, one of the places where I put a lot of emphasis, and we talk about it in the book, is the idea that when children are young, what should they be learning in order to be able to grow up and have healthy relationships in which sex is a part? And when they're young, they need to be learning about healthy, caring relationships. And instead, right now, they're learning about objectification with each other. Not only do they spend 4 to 6 hours a day glued to a screen when they're not relating to other people, but when they do relate, it's so much, you know, based on this kind of program.
In particular, they don't develop empathy. You know, they don't develop the ability to put themselves into another person's shoes, and that's absolutely crucial if you're going to have successful intimate relationships. So they're paying a very, very high price.
And you mentioned
earlier that the protective factor for girls in particular of being involved, having a deep interest, whether it's, you know, drama or writing courses or sports or whatever, is really important because it's an arena in which a girl can see herself as, you know, important and effective and active that has nothing to do with how she looks. And that's really important.
Yes. And when you say that these trends are happening, I don't know if you have statistics on it, but you're saying mostly because they're in front of the screen, meaning either video games, television, movies, any of the above.
Exactly.
Right. And that's something that parents really can control. You simply turn it off. You say, no, we're not. Sitting mindlessly in front of the TV is such a waste of time. And you just point it out. You know, you're better at this. You engage them in something else.
But you hit on a really important thing. You know, I never tell parents just to turn off the television. I help them think about how they can do it. If their child watches 4 hours a day, well, let's go down to 3 and let's help children think about what they can do for the other hour. That the more television or screen time a child has, the more of it they need. So it becomes harder and harder to limit it. So the younger you can start setting up rituals and routines for media exposure time, the better. But it's never too late. But just thinking, saying, okay, now we're going to turn off the television with your 10-year-old who's completely involved,
that's not a way to do it. Yeah. The American Academy of Pediatrics actually recommends, Maggie, no screen time at all for children under 2.
Oh, so, yes, I completely agree.
And that, I know that, speaking as a mother, I know that can sometimes be a lot to ask. I mean, there were times when I was desperate to put my daughter in front of the TV so I could take a shower. You know, I understand using the TV in that way, but it really isn't good for children.
Well, when you say TV, if you're putting on something that's slow-moving and a small, like almost reading, I had one tape like that, The Velveteen Rabbit or Winnie the Pooh or something, it's not overwhelming. We're talking about TV, but why TV when you can pick out a good tape or DVD?
Or read it to themselves.
But we mean any screen time when we're saying it,
Maggie,
because here's the thing. A lot of parents just focus on the content children are watching. If it's good content and they're careful about it, that certainly makes it better. But the other part of the process is how it changes children's taking initiative in the world, how kids come to expect the screen to tell them what to do to keep them occupied instead of them being bored a little while and discovering some new thing they can do, some way to build onto something they've done before. I actually have started calling that whole process of screen time creating for children problem-solving deficit disorders. They never come up with their own problems. They're always being given them.
And it's a very passive thing. I just talked about this in my hour before. It can also just not teach their brains to think, or it can overload their brains would be a way to put it.
Great.
Okay, we're up for a break, and we'll be back in just a moment with Diane Levin and Jean Kilbourn. So Sexy, So Soon is the title of their book. We'll be back in a moment with the Maggie Paschal Show.
You're listening to The Maggie Paschal Show on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And welcome back. You can hear this in its entirety if you go to my website, MaggiePascal.com, within a couple of days. And we are talking about popular culture and all that our kids are hit with at such an early age, and the new sexualized childhood and what parents can do to protect their kids. And the title is So Sexy, So Soon. Jean, you see a lot working with, as you said, the tweens and the teenagers. And do you work directly with them as well and talk to them?
I do sometimes, yes. I primarily lecture and I make films, and I quite often actually lecture at high schools, usually not any younger than that, and also, of course, at colleges and many other groups as well. So I do encounter teenagers quite a lot. And I also have a daughter who's just emerged from her teenage years. So.
Good.
Yeah.
But you, and I agree that things have increased over time. You've seen changes. You see it become more of an issue now than it was even 10 years ago.
I started talking about all of this back in the late 60s, early 70s, actually. Mm-hmm. And in my first film, Killing Us Softly, which I made in 1979, I actually had an image of a sexualized little girl and talked about this, the sexualization of children. In my wildest dreams or nightmares, I wouldn't have thought that it would come to where it is today. It's so much worse now, so much more extreme, so much more graphic, so much more accepted than it was then. And there's also infinitely more pressure on girls now to be beautiful and thin and perfect-looking and to be very hot and sexy starting at very, very early ages. So in the 30-odd years that I've been doing this work, this aspect of it has certainly gotten much, much worse.
Really, it's too bad, because there's so much for them to become this whole human being, and to reduce them to that at such an early age, it's just wrong. So we're talking about finding appealing role models that provide alternative images to increasingly influential celebrity culture with its superstar icon. So finding other role models and pointing out their qualities and the things and the values that have made them strong people, that I think is key.
Oh, that's extraordinarily important. I think it's wonderful for parents to constantly comment about other people for the virtues that they really value. You know, if that person is so kind, or that person is so courageous, or that person is, you know, is so generous, rather than how people look. And something like that can make a very big difference. And pointing out that there are plenty of kind of everyday heroes in our lives, you know, not the ones who end up on reality shows or the ones who get a lot of attention, but they're doing actually quite wonderful things in their own communities.
Mm-hmm. And children are impressionable, and that's something that I had an experience of being around in 20-something and then a younger tween, and I had to say to them, put aside these magazines like the Us and the different fashion, and stop talking about everything that has to be designer and hair and all of this. It's just not the values that I want to be instilled in this tween at this time. And they didn't really see that, but I had to point that out to them. But, you know, that would go right into the gender stereotypes that you will talk about, which is to avoid the sexist comments about yourself and ask questions about any sexist comments you hear from your teen, and also with the supporting media that promote positive images of males and females. So
one thing just that really is important is for mothers, and I say mothers for the ones who tend to do it, to really not do the negative self-talk, you know. Or if you have, it's better not to do it at all, but if you have to do it, don't do it in front of your children, because it really has a tremendous impact. You know, I'm so fat, oh, I look so this or that. And women tend to do that to themselves inside our own heads all the time, but it's just so important not to.
Well, they're not our friends. We're the parents, so we can ask a friend if it makes us look fat or feel like it, but don't do it to the child.
Certainly don't ask the child, no.
Right, but that is something that's it's a good reminder.
Mm-hmm. One thing you started to refer to, Maggie, when you started talking about gender stereotypes, is we haven't really talked much about boys.
Yes, let's do that.
So, I don't want them to get lost, because what's happening is really harmful for them, too.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a lot of my work for years focused more on boys and the violence that they're socialized into. And gradually I began to see this huge gender division that was happening, that's bigger than before the women's movement began, for very young children in terms of narrowing what boys and girls can do. And boys are taught being violent, being ready to fight, having big muscles. That's what you need to be a successful boy and not to rely on other people and then to judge girls by how they look. And so, again, boys are objectified to be tough objects just as girls are objectified to be sexy objects. And it really is a problem in terms of boys being able to have relationships
mm-hmm.
with each other and with girls. But also when you think about as they grow up, how are they going to be able to have the kinds of relationships they need to be parents and caring, connected
right.
spouses?
Well, if you add that to a lack of connection in the family, that's, I think, or with their mother or with their father, as
mm-hmm.
that's when it's really open ground for that kind of infection. But if they want to be gentlemen and just good guys and so forth, and then they're confronted with girls that are acting in this way that's not very ladylike, then that I think that can mess up their head with their role,
right.
the role they're supposed to be playing. Absolutely.
And one of the things that happens is, I mean, there's an example in the book of a little boy who ends up, you know, getting into a terrible bind when he did what made perfect sense given how five-year-olds think, given what they're exposed to. But then we blamed him for doing it where he was with another. He said to a girl, "I want to have sex with you," when he was five. And the girl went home and told her parents, and they were ready to suspend him from school. And no one bothered to ask him what he meant. And when he finally went to the school counselor before they expelled him, she said, "What did you want to do?" And he started crying and said, "I liked her. I wanted to give her a kiss."
Right, so he didn't have any comprehension at 5 years old.
And that's another thing we have to realize. Kids are constantly getting into trouble for doing the things that make perfect sense, given what they're seeing. They don't understand it the way
right.
we do. The younger they are, the less they do so. One thing we hope the book is going to do is help parents connect more to the meanings children are making, to help parents have more conversations and be connected with their kids around what they're seeing and not just say, "Oh, that's terrible," and try to pour in how they, the adults, are thinking, but to actually ask the children what they think and take it from there, even though it's hard to do that. And it doesn't mean just about, you know, something that has to do with sex, but in general with the popular culture and things they're being exposed to.
In fact, let me just jump in with one thing, though, just referring back to what you said earlier, Maggie, is that I do have a problem with the word ladylike because I feel like girls often get the message that that can often be used to kind of make girls feel that it's up to them, you know, to control how boys act, and that it's that they have to be conform to a certain narrow stereotypical definition of what it means to be feminine or to be a girl. And that, of course, isn't anything that any of us want to see either. So I could use
some contained. I wouldn't be blaming the girl on any level, but I've just heard men say that they don't always understand their role.
Well, I think that boys and men are getting incredible mixed messages.
Right. That's what I mean.
Exactly. And that it's very, very tough for them. And they're learning. I hear often from very sweet young men that, you know, they're not the ones who are getting the girls, you know, because there's this, the popular culture, the sexy guy in the popular culture is often callous and cold and indifferent. And so these gentle and giving men are, at least when they're very young, don't have the same kinds of chances. So this is why we need to work very hard to educate boys and girls, you know, about
mm-hmm.
what makes a healthy relationship and what the benefits mm-hmm. are and how to have one, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that what you all are doing is saying, here are some practical ways, and it's a shame that it is so difficult that Hollywood or the people putting this stuff out has got so much influence. Something's wrong with that.
Well, you know, there used to be limits on advertising to children, and they're pretty much non-existent at this point. And that, in the mid-80s, children's television was deregulated, and before that you couldn't make TV shows to sell products. That's when I started setting this issue, when I started hearing from teachers all kinds of changes they were seeing in children's behavior, especially boys and their war play at that time, but more gender divisions as well. And that was when television was deregulated. That's when children became a separate consumer group to be marketed to. Research and all kinds of strategies were developed for how to market to them. So there's even been research on how to most effectively get children to nag their parents to buy your product.
Mm-hmm. The nag factor, they call it, or the whine factor. And this is such an important point that Diane just made, that so much of this really has to do with marketing and with the fact that children have value in our culture primarily as consumers.
Mm-hmm.
That if you look at our public policy, the way we fund our schools or don't fund them, you'd have to conclude that we're not a nation that cares a lot about our children, but marketers care a lot about them. And so we allow them to be targeted starting at very, very early age. And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from, because the marketers are not only using sex to sell stuff to them, but they're getting them in their minds to associate sex with shopping so that they feel that they are what they buy, which, of course, is a marketer's dream.
Well, they're doing it to the adults as well.
Sure are. Yeah, absolutely. But as you pointed out, Maggie, earlier, kids are much more vulnerable, especially the little children. They don't have the same kinds of abilities to sort of analyze or step
right.
back and that adults do, or even teenagers do.
Younger children don't even have the ability to understand the intent of ads.
Right. Oh, yes, I remember that. The first time my children would see a sale, oh, we have to go to Limited 2. There's this, and I think, wait,
right.
this is an advertiser. You don't understand, but it was
yeah.
convincing information that sounded good.
Exactly. And kids don't have the ability to understand
right.
persuasive intent is what they call it in the industry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then we get into saying no, and
mm-hmm.
and you talk about saying no, but explaining it and not just hard and fast, no explanation, but actually talking it out.
We think saying no cuts parents off from doing a lot of the things that are important to help children cope with what they're being exposed to. We see certainly parents need to set limits, and there are times to say no, but we see if you just say no, what you're doing is not talking to your kids about what they're interested in. They learn not to use you as a resource. What we want kids to do is see adults as helpful people, not as marketers have them creating premature adolescent rebellion so kids dismiss adults as having anything valuable to say at younger and younger ages.
I think we've also seen how totally ineffective just say no has been with drugs.
Well, I was just about to say that.
Completely. I mean, if anything, it made the problem much, much worse. So it's not enough.
Well, Jean, I know, I agree. I mean, for a certain level, and somewhere in your mind, yes, learning to say, in all fairness to Nancy Reagan and what she had to say, is the idea of there is a place where you just take a stand. But I had a program, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, on drug abuse with some scientists, and they took that just say no, N-O, and changed it to just say no, K-N-O-W. And I loved that. And they said, we're going to come in with information and we'll equip people with information, especially kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that can make a difference. So you can really say the same thing. Understand what you're being given. Talk it out. Think it out. Understand the motives behind what you're being offered.
But when you say no, it's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of doing it in a way where you try to reach some agreement and understanding at a level at which children can understand. Because it's through the
yeah.
way you say no that the goal is really not just to say no, but for kids to learn lessons about the thing that's the problem.
And you work with children, so you know that you get on their level. You say it in a way they can understand.
Yeah.
And
you let them lead. I mean, too, you create, above all, a safe atmosphere so that your children learn early on that it's absolutely safe to come to you and talk about absolutely anything, to bring up any sort of question or concern, that they'll never be shamed, they'll never be told, that they shouldn't be thinking such thoughts. Instead, you will do your best to really answer them and respond to them and have a good conversation with them.
And wait a little bit, which is not that easy all the time, to hear what they know, not to make assumptions.
Right.
To actually hear what they know, what their questions are, and it might be something pretty simple. And not to assume.
Well, like Diane's story about the little boy who said he, wanted to have sex with a little girl. If any adult in his life had just taken the time to ask him what he meant by that initially, all this trouble could have been avoided, because oftentimes children say things and we think we know what they mean, but it's not what they mean at all.
I know. They hear a word in a certain context and that's where they put it. It's actually kind of sweet and cute, but it just needs to be understood. So, overreaction, and I do think that is something that's going on. I don't think anyone can deny it. When a kindergartner is in trouble for playing cowboys and Indians and that kind of thing, or something like you just described when the little boy meant a kiss, there does seem to be, along with everything else, an overreaction on the part of everybody.
Well, first things, all these things are happening around media and commercial culture, and it certainly was clear in a lot of my work on children and violence, where kids end up getting in trouble too for doing things that they're seeing on the screen. And we need to understand that there are reasons why kids do things, and we need to get more at the reason rather than just at the symptom. Rather than just the action, the problem, the illness.
In some ways, there's certainly been an overreaction, but there's also been an underreaction. There should be more of a sort of uproar about the way the kids are being targeted by marketers, the age at which we let them be targeted, the kinds of images that these kids are subjected to. There should be a lot more reaction to that, and then we should dial down the kind of overreaction when these kids act in ways that are completely predictable given what they've been exposed to.
Exactly. So while we're ignoring or not really focusing in or don't want to have to deal with all that's coming at them, the result is what we're reacting to.
Right, and the other thing that happens besides blaming kids is blaming parents. There are a lot of people who say, well, if parents just did their job, we wouldn't have a problem.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry works very hard to put the blame on parents.
They sure do.
So that they don't need to take any responsibility themselves. And it's clear that parents can't... The job of parenting is being made much harder. We wrote So Sexy So Soon to help parents handle it better, but not to make them think the whole job is theirs.
And they are influenced by what they see. That's why the advertisers spend so much money. So it's not fair to say that they're not. The statistics don't prove that to be true. Okay, we have to wrap it up. We'll be back in just a moment. One more segment.
You're listening to The Maggie Paschal Show on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Welcome back. We're talking to the authors of So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. And we're coming up with many different perspectives. And, Diane, we were saying during the break that parents can go out of their own situation with their own children and help on a bigger, larger level. What are some suggestions?
We think that, parents need to start talking to other parents more. The more parents are divided, the more kids can conquer and industry, kind of the marketing can conquer. So we think a lot about how parents and schools can work together, how parents and other parents can work together, how family members, the story I gave earlier about extended family, I've been helping this mother be able to talk more to other family members so that in the future her wishes for her daughter are more regarded. But so there are many levels at which we can work.
We're not all alone. Being in touch with the parents of your friends is huge. Just trust me. I've had four, and I promise you, extended family also, the support there. We don't always have that. Sometimes we get those cousins that are allowed to see everything and so forth, and then so it can work in the opposite direction.
Right. You need to know which ones will be your allies. For sure.
And we can help each other. Jean, would you like to comment about that? Are you there? Is Jean there?
Oh, here.
Oh, she is?
I don't hear it.
Oh,
talking.
We love
no.
Jean. I thought she was being awfully quiet.
Right, me
okay,
too.
Okay, we'll get her back.
Okay, because, one thing that she probably would say as you're getting her is also thinking about how to complain in the wider society about what's going on, finding ways to have a voice, getting communities involved in these issues, complaining when you go to a store and something's right there in child view that shouldn't be there.
I think that's fantastic. When you see something that's offensive, when there is a problem, to go ahead and make that call, or I've done it easily.
I keep the phone numbers for TV and radio stations by my telephone so that I can call them if there's something that seems really outrageous on the screen during children's television viewing time.
Very good.
But another is I helped found an organization called Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. And parents who really want to get involved in little ways can go to the website commercialfreechildhood.org.
Hmm.
And at that site, there are examples of dozens of campaigns we've launched around a whole range of issues, including sexualization of childhood issues.
And
we've had victories.
Oh, that's what I wanted to ask you. So tell me about that.
Okay, it took a while. Well, one of the ones related to the So Sexy, So Soon topic is a couple of years ago, one of the big toy manufacturers was about to release a doll to compete with the Bratz dolls that was based on the burlesque female singing group called Pussycat Dolls, mm-hmm. and which is very highly sexualized, and they were going to be for seven-year-olds and up a whole line of dolls. Based on those characters, and we launched a campaign. We asked our members to write letters to the toy company, which was Hasbro, and Hasbro within 3 days said they were not releasing the dolls, and they have not.
All right. So there was success in keeping those off the market completely?
Yes, they have not appeared.
Oh, good for you.
We also filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. Welcome.
Well, okay, but now I'm on my cell phone, so you probably can't hear me very well. I'm sorry, for some reason you just lost me.
Welcome back.
Here I am. I'm back. Okay. Sorry, I missed whatever you've been talking about.
Oh, we were talking about the idea of making a difference in the larger culture through things like commercialfreechildhood.org and how the dolls that you all were successful in keeping the Pussycat dolls. Yeah.
I don't know if you also talked about, one of the things we talk about in So Sexy So Soon is how important it is to teach sex education in the schools. Did you get to that yet?
Perfect. No, that's what I was just going to say to you, Jean.
We very much feel that every developed nation in the world except the United States teaches accurate, honest, age-appropriate sex education, and not just education about sex, but also education about relationships and about, you know, how to communicate and that kind of thing. And this is so important, and yet we have a culture in which that isn't done, and then we blame the kids when they get pregnant or they get STDs and that sort of thing, or we blame the parents. We also feel that we should be teaching media literacy in the schools, helping kids become critical viewers, mm-hmm. so they'll be less easily manipulated by all this.
Oh, I like that idea, media literacy. And I know, and so much depends on what, and you touched on it, what you're teaching in sex education. If you're teaching, because there's a lot of variety in that, I'm aware of that too. So responsibly teaching it at age appropriately.
Right. And just say no doesn't work with drugs or, you know, it also doesn't work with sex. So teaching abstinence only is a proven failure. So
as we know from what's happening with politics right now.
That should be part of it.
Which we shouldn't know so much about. We should know things about other things as well. But
right.
Absolutely. So you were talking about this commercial-free childhood.
Campaign for commercial-free childhood.
Now, give us an example of something else that you've been able to actually, as consumers, make a call, or as concerned parents or people and so forth, educators, that you've made phone calls and you've taken some initiative, and I'd like to hear about how the response is.
Well, one of our big successes has been with Baby Einstein toys. We filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission because we claim there was very little research to support the claims mm-hmm. on the toy boxes for the kinds of intellectual benefits they provided, and there was a growing body of research mm-hmm. that it may have been the reverse.
I've heard this.
And so we filed that complaint, and the Federal Trade Commission has ruled that we were correct, and mm-hmm. Baby Einstein is changing its marketing practices. That was another huge success.
Very good. Somebody needs to point it out to them.
Right now, this week, we launched a campaign around a kind of company called Bus Radio that is, that is on school buses that all children have to hear. And we were concerned about the advertising that they were doing on bus radio. And at this point, we're asking our members on our e-list to send letters you know, to complain about that.
Very good.
Maggie, I don't know if Diane mentioned this, but we do have a website, sosexysosoon.com, and there's an extensive resource list on the website with links to all of these organizations, such as the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood and many other organizations, so parents can get involved in many different ways. And I think one of the things we found as we were writing So Sexy, So Soon is that there's a lot of concern by parents, but there's also a sense of powerlessness,
yes.
a sense of not being able to, what can I possibly do against such huge forces? So that's why it's so important, I think, to celebrate our successes and to get involved in trying to bring about change.
And they can. And I had talked to a dad a few years ago on Father's Day, and he said, for my daughters, I'm going to help change the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he is doing this kind of thing as well with boycotting and educating people with the advertisers that support some of these products. One would be some of the stores, clothing stores you go into, the music is so loud and obnoxious, and it's just too much. And the pictures, I'm sure you can probably imagine who I'm talking about. I won't go into some of those clothing stores, but that is another way that they're bombarding our kids, and that's just shopping for clothes.
Right.
And that's easy. You can complain directly right there in the store and then get a phone number.
You certainly can, and if more people did it, it would really make a difference. Again, it's that sense of powerlessness, and my voice is so small, but if many of us speak up, then our voice becomes much stronger.
I mean, one thing I tell people when I speak to groups is just make trouble however you can. You know, make a commitment. Once a week you're going to cause trouble, or once a month you're going to cause trouble, but just do it.
Yeah.
I think somebody sent me something where it said, you always want to be one of those people that I think it was actually women, that when you wake up and your feet hit the floor, the little demons go, oh, no, she's awake.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of what you're saying right now. But, people do pay attention to the feedback they're getting from consumers. So there is power in that. And we are being attacked mostly by the people who are selling. So that
I think we also need to ask the government to play a greater role. That it's not just the marketers. The government used to play a role in balancing the interests of corporations and the public and children. And the government isn't doing that right now, and we need a government that's going to take it on again.
We certainly need a government that's much more responsive to the needs of children and the needs of
yes.
parents and families than to the needs of corporations.
Well, so often it comes under that First Amendment rights, and that's you wonder where the judgment goes on some of that. But again, you make a great point when you say parents and people feel powerless, but we're not.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not. And we can in our own personal relationship with our children, but also on a larger scale. So
that's absolutely true. Right.
So we are down to, I think, our last 7 minutes, six. So what did we miss? What else do you want to make sure that people know listening, or even just talking to the kids that are listening, the tweens and the teens? Probably not the little ones, I wouldn't
right.
think.
Probably not the little ones, no. I think that I would want people to look around, sort of understand where the problem comes from. That this isn't sort of happening for no reason at all. It's really happening, as we talked earlier about, from a push at turning kids into consumers at earlier and earlier ages, and that we are not powerless and alone. There's a great deal we can do about it. We have guidelines for in So Sexy, So Soon for parents of little kids as well as parents of teens. And we also talk about what we can do to change in the wider world to make a real difference and to create a much safer, healthier world for all children everywhere.
Now, I want to mention, Jean, I'm looking here at your bio, that you have had these award-winning films, Killing It Softly, Slim Hopes, Spin the Bottle, and How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel. And you're on Oprah. Congratulations. That's great. And have testified before Congress and the Surgeon General. So you are taking it to big media as well as to the Surgeon General. What did you say to what was that about?
Well, that was more about alcohol advertising, actually, because I've been working about alcohol and tobacco advertising for many years as well. So both in my testimony to Congress and in my work with the Surgeon General, it was about alcohol advertising and tobacco advertising. But Diane has testified for Congress on these issues, right, Diane?
That's right. I actually testified before the Senate Commerce Committee on Marketing Violence to Children and the problems that that was causing. And in Massachusetts, I've been doing testifying at our legislature here around marketing in schools. So both Gina and I are involved in many, many, you know, aspects, because you can't isolate one out. It's kind of like you divide the issues and you lose some of the power. We're hoping to help parents connect the dots and see that lots of things going on that make parenting hard for them are connected, and to develop a lens for looking at them so they can work with their kids in ways that really help everybody do better.
So when you go before Congress and when you talk to the Surgeon General, what is the response that you get? Are you getting, or is there a response to it, or do you have to make it about money and how the marketers are being affected?
Well, I mean, in my case, I was testifying for Congress in support of a bill to put warning labels on alcohol ads, and that didn't happen, so it didn't work. But I did feel that it was important to be there and to testify. And in terms of working with the Surgeon General, I worked with two, actually, and both of them did do some quite significant work, particularly around tobacco advertising.
Very good, because that is obviously kids are being targeted indirectly, if not directly.
And in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, the Massachusetts legislature, after the hearings that we talked about in terms of marketing in schools, they ended up introducing, being the first state in the country introducing legislation to ban marketing in schools, even though they figure it will take several years to pass it. They've begun the process now.
To ban marketing in schools?
Yes.
You know, Maggie, there are countries in the world that do not allow advertising at all to young children. And so it's not a kind of dream to think that this is something that might be possible, that it's only as really relatively recently that we've allowed our kids to be targeted in this way. So it might be possible to
turn it back.
Stop that.
But, I mean, when you say marketing the schools, how are they being marketed right now in the schools?
Oh, many ways, from curriculum materials that are provided by companies to the something like Scholastic Book Fair that has books that are linked to other products. You know, they have Barbie books and Bratz doll books and things that are linked to other products that have ads in them. So there's that. There's the kind of junk food that's marketed in machines. And, you know, so that's another way they're marketed to try to get brand loyalty at very young ages. England has instituted a ban on marketing junk food in schools, for instance.
Yes, but there are posters in the hallways of schools and on the book covers and everywhere kids walk now. They're just surrounded.
We actually launched a campaign, a campaign for commercial-free childhood, when a parent in Florida complained to us that her daughter came home from third grade with her report card in an envelope from McDonald's that had a McDonald's coupon.
Oh, my God.
That was another success we had.
I'm glad you said those specifics, because I don't think that we always think of it. It's so much a part of our lives that we're not always aware of it. So that's great. Thank you, both of you, for what you're doing and for the fight and taking it on so many levels.
Thank you.
All right. Well,
thanks, Maggie. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. All right. And, the rest of you, have a wonderful rest of your evening and week, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Loving might be a mistake.